This week, we are going to cover a topic that was sent to us by a listener, but is also a topic that's going to be a bit challenging to discuss, because this week we're going to talk about what happens when we get it wrong. What happens when we think about making mental health diagnoses, when we talk about the process of making a diagnosis and deciding a treatment plan, what happens if we get it wrong?
And it's easy, I don't want to say it's easy to get it wrong, but it's challenging to get it right.
You don't want to say it's easy to get wrong, but it's easy to get it wrong.
Right. We have 400 and some diagnoses in DSM-5. You really have to know that manual. Mm-hmm. You have to know it intimately in order to get it right.
Right.
There are subtle differences in these various. First of all, you have symptom overlap.
Right.
And then there are subtle differences that, well, this would be the diagnosis except for, you know, and you have to know all the except fors.
Right.
Otherwise, you're going to end up with the wrong diagnosis.
Yeah.
So we're going to keep repeating that theme throughout the week, that that it is a it's a difficult, challenging business to make an accurate diagnosis. Yeah. It's more challenging in children than it is in adults.
Right.
Children are still developing. Their brains are still developing. They are still developing. They're going to go through some developmental changes during early adolescence and late adolescence. So it's more challenging in children than adults. But it's challenging across the lifespan to get it right. There are many ways to get it wrong. And the reason that an accurate diagnosis is important is, and we're going to probably say this every day, is diagnosis guides treatment.
Right.
And if you want the right treatment, you begin with the right diagnosis.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Before we get into that, those of you that are watching on YouTube probably notice a difference.
That's right.
We have moved into a different room in our office suite, and we're still putting things together, trying to figure out what's going to happen.
Right.
We're going to try some different graphics and some different things to go along with it. So we have a blank canvas behind us, but
it won't be blank.
It actually, when you're watching it, should not be completely blank. If our IT person is able to do their job. I think that's me.
Which is always, talk about challenges. No, this is good. The cameras, we have a different setup here.
Yes.
And it's a little disconcerting because we've gotten used to a certain setup. We had it for 514 podcasts or something.
In the least.
Right. And now we've changed everything. So the camera's farther away and everything's farther away.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
But I like it better. I didn't like the camera when it was so close. It felt intrusive, intimidating. Yeah. Showed all my little imperfections.
Just the little ones.
the tiny. No, the big. It shows all your imperfections.
Yeah.
It's very disconcerting to talk and have yourself so close on the screen.
Right.
So this is a little bit more. Comfortable,
it is, and again, hopefully,
feels more like a conversation, than a recording.
Yeah, it does, and hopefully, I'm just hoping that I'll be able to get everything edited in time for everything to go out on time.
And I hope that you appreciate it as much as we. I like this. I like the difference. I like the distance. But I hope it works as well for you as it does for us.
Yeah.
And if not, as always, let us know.
Yeah, yeah. The lighting is different, and hopefully, that all helps. So, all right, so today we're going to focus on, as we introduce this idea of misdiagnoses and when we get it wrong, today we're going to talk about some of the general challenges associated with making a diagnosis. And over the course of the week, we're going to highlight other very specific points, especially as it relates to diagnosing children, diagnosing adults, and so on. So the article that we linked in the show notes is talking about the importance of your diagnosis. And it's a great introduction to why it's important that your diagnosis is correct.
That's right. And it's written for the patient. for the client. Because it is, after all, your diagnosis. I mean, it's our obligation to get it right for you. And so we begin the week with the importance of the diagnosis for you.
Right.
And that's where the emphasis, I think, where the emphasis should be.
Right, yeah.
We want to get it right for you.
Absolutely. So when we think about the challenges of making the diagnosis, you know, you mentioned probably the biggest challenge a moment ago, and that's the fact that there are over 400, close to 500 different diagnoses, and that's just in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual.
That's right.
You know, there is nothing that completely obligates mental health professionals to use the DSM-5. You don't have to.
That's right.
You know, as long as you can find a if you're billing insurance especially, as long as you can find a code from the International Classification of Diseases, the ICD, that's another book that has all mental health and physical health diagnoses in it. As long as you can find a code that you can bill that the insurance company will reimburse for, you're fine. But otherwise, there is nothing that obligates you to use the DSM-5.
It's just the
generally accepted manual.
So one issue is you don't have to use DSM-5. But you mentioned ICD, which is in its 10th edition. So the manual is in its 5th edition. International Classification of Diseases is in its 10th edition.
Right.
There was a study done in England, reported in the Lancet about 3 years ago, that took the symptoms of 300 patients and had one group of professionals use DSM-5 and one group of professionals use ICD-10. Same symptoms.
Right.
Ended up with completely different diagnoses. And so there are these structural problems in the field of psychiatry. One of them is it's there are no lab tests. We're going to talk about that later in the week. But you have these two books, and each can produce a different diagnosis. So that's one of the many challenges. We're going to talk about other challenges during the week, but I think what we're focusing on, what we're emphasizing here today, is there are a number of challenges in getting an accurate diagnosis, but it's absolutely essential that you get an accurate diagnosis. Otherwise, you're going to select the wrong treatment.
Absolutely. And so, like, just as a brief example of other sources, you know, when you work in education, your diagnostic manual, if you want to call it that, doing air quotes, your diagnostic manual. I hate doing this. Your diagnostic manual in education is the Individuals with Disability Education Act. It lists specific diagnoses, diagnoses, but they refer to them as exceptionalities, used to identify students who need special services. And those are diagnoses, you know, loosely speaking, they're diagnoses. Now, an insurance company isn't going to reimburse for those diagnoses, but when it comes to receiving services in school, those diagnoses are critical.
You
can't take just any DSM diagnosis and receive services in school unless it also meets criteria for one of their diagnoses.
That's right, and those are in a federal definition. These are in law. That you have to meet, your child has to meet these specific criteria in order to be given that category, in order to fit into that category. It's not just because you have a reading problem or a math problem. There are very there are about 10 now, I think, categories. So, for example, your child can have ADHD, but that's not a specific category. It comes under another category, and you need to know these subtle differences. So that's a good point, is that you have to live by these categorization schemes.
And there are many others. There's one birth to three or something like that. And it's a much smaller manual, but there's a whole manual of diagnoses for that particular age group, and is made by a different organization.
For very young.
Insurance companies aren't necessarily going to reimburse for that unless they correlate with other diagnoses. But there's, so there's lots of different manuals out there. Some choose to go by those, and but most insurance companies and sort of the generally accepted manual is the DSM.
Right.
Another major factor, and then we're going to kind of delve into this much more deeply later this week, is individual differences within the field related to training and professional experience.
That's right.
You know, the it's interesting. Is interesting the right word? It's interesting when you start talking with, you know, from professional to professional, the various experiences they have, the training that they have, and thus the perspective that they come from when they're making a diagnosis. I think that your example from that Lancet article is perfect because, you know, all of those professionals, we would assume, are well-trained, they're licensed, they you know, they know their craft, but then they come up with different diagnoses.
Right.
And it can't be, we would have to hope, that it can't be because some of them are competent and some of them are incompetent, or because some of them just, you know certain diagnoses and don't know other diagnoses. It has to be that they come from different training perspectives, they come from different schools of thought, and so when they see particular patterns of symptoms, it guides them in one direction or another, and they follow that for their diagnosis.
Right. We are going to talk about that later in the week, specifically about those kinds of training issues, theoretical background. So there's training, there's your theoretical background, there's how you were trained during your residency or during your internship, what was emphasized. For example, I began my work in pediatric neurology. You began yours in developmental pediatric, well, pediatric psychiatry,
okay?
Because you were trained by a psychiatrist, I was trained by a neurologist, and we would frequently approach something from those two perspectives.
Right.
And then both of us did developmental pediatrics, that's a third perspective.
Right.
So do you see it as a neurological disorder, a psychiatric disorder, or a developmental disorder? Those are three very different perspectives.
Absolutely.
And the reason we have this confusion, the possible confusion, is because the psychiatric diagnoses, there are no lab tests.
Right.
They are all based on clinical symptoms, okay?
Right.
And I think of all the words we're going to use this morning, I think symptoms is one of the most important.
Right.
Because in our business, we're left with making a decision based on observable symptoms, not on a lab test.
Right.
We don't have, there's no SPECT, MRI, EEG.
Absolutely.
There's nothing available today. There's no technology that exists today that will tell you whether or not you have a mental illness, or what that mental illness is.
Absolutely.
Regardless of claims, there is no technology.
Well, and I think that what's another great point pulling from what you were just saying, in psychiatry there are no lab tests.
Right.
In neurology even, in developmental pediatrics even, the only lab tests we have are for those things that are structural or you know, based upon some direct injury or insult to the brain or to
that's
regions
right.
that affect development or neurological functioning. But if you go to a neurologist with symptoms of ADHD, there are no lab tests for that. I mean, just because you're seeing a neurologist. So even in these other domains, there are still no lab tests that you can use to say, you know, this is what the problem is or that's what the problem is. And it leaves little to wonder why, you know, some people are very skeptical of the mental health field because there are no, because we don't have these lab tests, and it requires such, and I don't want to oversell it, but I don't want to undersell it either. It requires such clinical precision to get it correct, that you know, that it does raise some concerns as far as accuracy and reliability, because it can change.
Right. And even with all these problems, there, every once in a while, and I didn't read hundreds of articles, but I reviewed dozens and dozens of articles for this week's podcast. And every once in a while, you'd come up with one that would be, there is no such thing as mental illness.
Right.
You know, these are hollow. There are things like mental illness.
Right.
Okay, and so that's the other thing. Not destructive, but it's a disservice. It does a disservice
right.
to say that there is no such thing
right.
as a mental illness. Okay, and so we also want to make that point that no, there are mental illnesses, and if you've ever had one, or if you have a relative who has one, you know that they are real.
Right.
We might not have a diagnostic test for them, but they are real.
Right.
But you make a good point. There are some times when, for example, there's a lot of information today about concussion.
Right.
Okay. If you suffer brain damage, yeah, then we can find that.
Right.
There are diagnostic tools that we can use to find a brain injury.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that brain injury might lead to psychiatric symptoms.
Right.
But in the absence of an injury, there are no diagnostic tests.
Right. And just to make that really clear, we all know what a concussion is. But there's not a lab test for
no.
a concussion unless it causes, profound injury, structural, physical injury
right.
to the brain.
It has to damage tissue.
Right.
Enough tissue that you can see it
right.
on a scan.
Right. And it would have to be, there are very few labs that look at it in enough precision
right.
to identify some minor swelling and things like that from a concussion.
Right.
But generally speaking,
mm-mm.
It's just a symptom.
And we always tell patients, you don't want to find anything
right.
on any neuroimage, an x-ray, a CT,
right.
an MRI. You don't want to find anything
right.
because if you can find it, it's significant.
Yeah.
It's serious and it's significant. So that's a point I think that we need to keep emphasizing.
Mm-hmm.
No blood test, no lab test. There's nothing you can bring with you to say, I have this. There's no place in the world that you can go that will put you into some kind of a machine and tell you that you have a mental illness, let alone differentiate one mental illness from another mental illness,
right.
which some people claim they can differentiate ADHD from, autism spectrum
right.
disorder. We don't have that kind of technology simply doesn't exist today.
Right.
Okay, so buyer beware.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The last thing I'm going to mention is that, because we're going to talk about this later this week as well, I didn't tell you about this, so this is a surprise for you.
He does this every once in a while.
We had a comment on one of our videos on YouTube that was challenging the idea of mental health treatment in general, therapy in general.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was that that therapy doesn't work. That the only, if you have a mental health condition, the only thing that you are, that's possibly helpful for you would be medication. And I'm mentioning that here because later this week, one of the topics we're going to really focus on is treatment. What happens when you recommend a treatment and that treatment is incorrect?
When you say incorrect, you mean ineffective?
Ineffective or makes things worse.
Oh, makes it, okay.
Because
I was thinking sometimes our treatment makes it worse, not
right.
better. Right.
Right. And so we're gonna talk about that and be very honest and frank about what that means and what happens in those circumstances. But when I see comments like that, or when I hear people talking about things
right.
like that, the first thing that I think of is, okay, this could be a person or is likely a person who has some experience and maybe had the wrong diagnosis made or had the wrong treatment,
mm-hmm.
didn't find effectiveness, went to someone else, they got it right.
Right.
And so then you gain the perspective that, okay, this is what's going to help you find benefit. And, it's concerning for reasons that we talked about a moment ago that, there's a lot of skepticism about this field in general. But when you get it right, when you apply the right intervention, it's impressive what happens to the brain even when,
mm-hmm.
when things change.
Right.
I remember reading about Joe Torgerson. He used to,
mm-hmm.
he does research with reading
right.
and he would work with kids who were dyslexic. And again, there's not really a lab test for dyslexia. There's no, you can look at how their brain functions, you know, through spectral or neural scans. You can see how their brain is functioning while they're reading, but you know, there isn't anything to say specifically that, okay, that's a dyslexic brain or that's this brain. We just look for trends and things like that. But when you see a person's brain and they're not reading well, but you scan them while they're reading, you apply an intervention, and then you scan their brain while they're reading again, when you have the intervention right, the brain changes in much the same way that it would change if you applied a medication or some chemical treatment to it. So we know that therapy, treatment, training changes the way the brain functions. And so when we get it right, we can make it change in the way that we need it to change, I guess is what I'm trying to get to. The treatment is going to be driven by the diagnosis, and you just have to get the diagnosis right to have success.
But we don't want you to think that by scanning your brain, we can tell where your reading problem,
right,
that you have a reading problem.
Right, that's what I mean, right.
Yeah, it's groups of kids.
Right.
You know, it's large groups that we scan. Mm-hmm. You know, the best work in that was done by the Shaywitz. Ben and Sally Shaywitz at Yale. And they did all those original fMRI studies, mm-hmm. functional magnetic resonance imaging. And it was a major contribution to the field. Of I mean, it was to me, it was Nobel Prize worthy.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just so important to the field of reading.
Right.
And yet they'll be the first to tell you, no, we can't put one kid in a machine and say, yes, you have a reading disability.
Right.
It's part of, every child is part of a large research study.
Right. Yeah. That's why it's not diagnostic, but you can use it to monitor. You can use it to look for changes. And so you see what it looked like at baseline, you apply an intervention, and then see what it looks like after the treatment, and you can see differences.
Right.
It's not diagnostic, but it's effective for monitoring. So
So you're making the point that all of our treatments, whether it's a drug treatment or if it's practice of some type, could change the brain in some
It does,
because the brain is plastic. It's
absolutely
it's malleable. You know,
it changes the brain, and because it changes the brain, the treatment matters.
Right.
This is how we get back to what we're talking about. The treatment matters, and the treatment is chosen based upon the diagnosis.
You know, a good example is phobias.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and what do we ask people to do? What do we use? We use exposure therapy.
Right.
So it's a gradual exposure.
Mm-hmm.
That changes a part of your brain.
Right.
You know, being exposed and being able to tolerate it changes the circuitry in that area of your brain.
Right.
Okay. So, yeah, they do. They do make those changes. Change the brain, you change your behavior.
Right. Mm-hmm. And change your behavior, change your brain. Goes both ways.
So, complicated?
Yes.
Okay. But take a look at this, the importance of your diagnosis.
Right.
You should begin to feel better relatively soon after you begin treatment, if the treatment is
correct,
is going to be effective.
Mm-hmm.
This idea of there's a little line in this article about your therapist is not just a friend who gets paid.
Right.
They're not just there to listen to you. Now, if that's what you want to do, that's fine.
If that's what you need.
If that's what you need, if you just want to get this stuff out, that's fine. But a therapist should also be doing something or have you do something. It may not be that the therapist is doing anything. It may be that the therapist asks you to do something different. But this shouldn't, these treatments shouldn't go on for years and years and years and years. Right. It may be that if you're not making progress, then perhaps the therapist should get a second opinion. Somebody should request a second opinion.
Right.
But you should begin to make progress. Mm-hmm. If you have the right diagnosis and you have the right treatment, huge questions, you should begin to make some progress, at least get symptomatic relief.
Right.
Okay. If you're taking a medication and after a month or two there's no change, well, it's not the right medication.
Right.
So let's change something. Mm-hmm. Okay. It may take a while to get the right combination of drug and non-drug treatments, but if you keep working at it, you're going to get some relief.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. All right.
But don't be cautious about spending too many months. If nothing happens within a few months, let's consider making some changes.
Some adjustments needed. Mm-hmm. Right. All right, that's it for today then. Tomorrow we're going to talk about some of the commonly misdiagnosed conditions.
Yes.
And we'll focus on that tomorrow. So until next time, stay happy, stay healthy, and forget to be afraid.